Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he had made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I am going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied.
So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal has devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it.
As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt.
Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It's my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on a sackcloth, and mourned for his son for many days. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard.
Years passed. Joseph eventually became an important official working for Pharaoh. One of his jobs was to manage the food distribution during a prolonged famine that had hit the land. Many miles away, Jacob and his sons were suffering from the famine. They had heard that there was food in Egypt, so the brothers went and requested help. They had no idea that the important Egyptian official who had the power to help them was actually their long-lost brother who they had sold into slavery.
Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." Then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept, and Benjamin embraced him, weeping. And he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. Afterwards, his brothers talked with him.
Thank you. Morning, everyone. Great to be back here with you again. I get to come about once a year, usually, to see you all. I usually come with greetings from Wellsprings Chapel in Taunton. I'm not going to do that today. I'm going to bring you greetings from Wellsprings Community Church in Taunton, because we've changed our name. We're officially now Wellsprings Community Church. Normally, I come here and watch and think, it must be hard work every week putting out chairs and getting everything ready and setting up sound systems and all that sort of stuff. But we're happy in our nice building. And our building is being extended at the moment. We've got a project, it's more than we could ever possibly dream of, really. Hundreds of thousands of pounds going on. And at the moment, we're meeting in the local primary school. So every week, we set up chairs and sound systems, and so for the first time ever, I'm coming and joining you and thinking, "Oh, your people work hard every week, and they do a good job." And I'd say thank you to those who do that each week, and encourage you to thank them and to be get involved, maybe, because it's hard work each week doing that. So that's really great that you can do that. Every Tuesday, we have a house group that meets in my house, and usually on those Tuesdays, there's someone who I go and collect, a lady. It would take me an hour to explain her story, but she comes and has a meal with us and then stays for house group each week. I mentioned, I don't know why, but for some reason I mentioned this week that I was going to be coming here and that I was going to be talking about Joseph. And instantly, Susie, my wife, and Tracy, this lady who comes and has a meal with us every week, started singing. Because that's what people do when they think about Joseph. Way, way back many centuries ago, not long after the Bible began, Jacob lived in the land of Canaan, a fine example of a... Yeah, you know... It's one of the most famous stories in the Bible. Probably the musical has done a lot to help with that. It's one of the most famous stories, this section about Jacob's family, this section about Joseph and what happens. But it's not always, I don't think, the most understood section. So we're going to try and see what we can learn, what we can bring out from some of these things to do with Joseph. And then in a little bit later, in a few minutes, Stan, who's already been introduced, is going to come and join me. And I'll just do a little interview with Stan, just hopefully to encourage you and to encourage Stan and challenge him a little bit as well. But we'll see as we get there. So, as we begin the story that we had read to us, the Bible tells us, Genesis 37, verse 2, Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. You already know Jacob had an interesting family. This is one of those occasions where the Bible tells us something and we don't always quite understand how strange this family was. Let me give you a family tree. There's Jacob, there's his wives, Leah and Rachel. You know what happened. Jacob falls in love with Rachel, he wants to marry her, he gets tricked, he gets conned into marrying the wrong sister. He works for 7 years to get her and ends up with the wrong one. He has to work another 7 years to get the one that he wanted. But in the meantime, he's wanting his children, and the colours there hopefully match up nicely. So you can see which are Leah's children. And which are Zilpah's children? And which are Bilhah's children? And then which are Rachel's children? Rachel, his one true love. The one who he'd worked 14 years to marry. The one who was most precious and loved by him. And which were her children? And can you see why Joseph was so special to Jacob? The firstborn to the wife who was his intended all along. Can you see why there'd be some favoritism shown to Joseph? And the thing is, Joseph knows that he's the favorite. And there's nothing worse than having a favorite child who knows that they're the favorite. Because they can get away with anything. His brothers know that he's the favorite. Jacob loved his wives and he loved his children, but not as much as he loved Joseph. But God was with Joseph. Joseph would bring a bad report, the passage tells us, about his brothers. That never makes you popular with your family. But God was with Joseph. He gets given an ornate robe to wear. Tuesday mealtime, Tracy sang, I don't know how she remembered it, every single colour from the song. It was red and yeah, and she went for about 5 minutes reciting all these colours. That's one of those interesting ones. We all know that he had a technicoloured robe, a coat. Except our translation tells us that it was ornate. And actually, if we look at the Hebrew there, what it actually means is long-sleeved. It may have been ornate in colour. The word can also mean striped. But it doesn't matter where it all comes from, but it's a word that means long-sleeved. And in that culture, especially if you're a farmer, you don't wear long sleeves. because you can't get the work done looking after the sheep, especially at lambing time and things like that. But Jacob gives Joseph an ornate robe. He gives him a robe that has long sleeves. And what does that mean? He's not going to do any of the work. He's not going to be a shepherd. He's going to be the person who tells everyone else what to do. Not only is he his favorite, he's now placed him in a position where he is in authority. And within that culture, that did not happen. And so, you can understand why he's hated by his brothers. They couldn't speak a kind word to him, is what it said. But God was with Joseph. And then he has his dreams. We didn't hear about them in the reading. We don't need to hear about them. But basically, each of the dreams was Joseph standing before his brothers, and after he told them the dream and told them the explanation, he would say, and that means I'm better than you. Because you're going to bow down and you're going to worship me. If you've got a brother or a sister, think about what it's like if they were to come in and say, you're going to bow down and worship me. What reaction that would cause in you. It tells us in verse 8, because of this, they hated him even more. It's interesting, Joseph, his name, Hebrew Yosef, it means to increase or to add to. It means even more. In the Hebrew, it tells us here that his brothers, Yosef'd Yosef, they hated him even more. But God was with Joseph. Then they plotted to kill him. And we heard the story of how they didn't end up killing him, but they killed the goat and put the blood on the robe and sent it back to Dad and sold him to slavery in Egypt. But God was with Joseph. We need to skip through the story. You probably know the story. He arrives and he works for a man called Potiphar and everything goes well, and then Potiphar's wife tries to be involved with him. And he won't do that because it's Potiphar's wife and not his. And so he gets thrown into prison for something he hadn't done. But God was with Joseph. And while he's there, he meets the baker and he meets the cupbearer to Pharaoh, and they have dreams, and he explains their dreams to them and says that when these dreams happen and when the reality of these dreams happens and you're raised again to your position, remember me before Pharaoh. And the dreams come true. And Joseph's forgotten. But God was with Joseph. And then eventually Pharaoh has a dream and they remember that Joseph's good with dreams, and so they bring him out and he tells Pharaoh the meaning of the dream. He tells him what to put in place to enable them to survive. There's going to be a famine, but in the 7 years of good food, let's store up so that in the 7 years of famine, we've got enough. And Pharaoh makes him the second most important person in the whole of Egypt. Pharaoh gives him that position. But God was with Joseph. He's in charge of looking after the crops in the good times. He's in charge of distributing them during the famine time. And then, his brothers come to visit. They want to buy the food. They've heard that there's still food in Egypt, even though they don't have any in Canaan where they live. And we heard in the reading the amazing way that Joseph is able to reveal himself to his brothers. We're through to chapter 45, believe it or not, of Genesis already. In there, in verse 5, it says that Joseph tells them it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. In verse 7, he says, "But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." Verse 8, "So then it was not you who sent me here, but God." And in Genesis 50, at the verse on your news sheet for today, "What you meant for evil, God meant for good." Those dreams that he had of his brothers bowing down before him have come true. He now has the chance to get his revenge. But God was with Joseph. I found a quote from Charles Spurgeon. I don't very often quote Spurgeon, but we will today. "How wonderfully those two things meet in practical harmony, the free will of man and the predestination of God. Man acts just as freely and just as guiltily as if there were no predestination whatever. God ordains, arranges, supervises, and overrules just as accurately as if there were no free will in the universe." How does it work? People have free will and take actions, and yet God is able to take those actions and turn them into his plan and his purpose. Whatever, God was with Joseph. God was with Joseph in the good times, when he wasn't aware of it. God was with Joseph in the bad times, when he wasn't aware of it. God was with Joseph in the easy times, when he wasn't aware of it. God was with Joseph in the hard times, when he wasn't aware of it. God was with Joseph when he was aware of it, and when he wasn't aware of it. I'm going to ask Stan to come out and join me for a minute. Stan is someone that I've known now for 2 or 3 years, something like that, with his stepchildren. He would have been along to things that we do at the church, maybe some of the children sort of stuff that we've done. You've been along a little bit. Just very quick, can I take this out? Is that all right? Looking at sound people, yeah. We can pass it between us then as we go through. So you've been occasionally to some of the things that we've done, but what were you thinking about God, about church at that sort of time?
Hello, everyone. So as a stiff tip, my name's Stan. My real name's Simon, but I'm kind of known in the church and among my family as Stan, though, quite biblically. So I came to Taunton from sunny South Wales about 3 years ago to be with my partner. And my partner was a regular attender to the church. But I've been an atheist, was an atheist for probably about 30 of my 35 years on this planet. I used to talk to God as a child, but then God didn't talk back. So I assumed that there was no God, and then I stopped talking. But the last time I prayed to God as a child, I made a promise to him, and I said, "If ever you talk to me and I feel your presence, I will give myself to you, and I will do everything in my power to serve you." And then we went radio silent for 30 years. And I'd come to the church, and I'd be there with the stepchildren, and I'd be there to support my partner. And I could see the love, and I could see the family and the harmony with everything. But there was an emptiness inside me, and I could enjoy it, and I could feel happiness for them, but I couldn't feel anything for myself. But there was something comforting about being there, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And that's kind of where I was with that.
So 30 years of silence. But God was with Stan. Tell us what changed.
So not that long ago, and probably if it was 6 months, it's probably too long, it's probably less than that. There was a crisis in my life, and like things weren't... Not that things weren't great between me and my partner, but we were having problems about different things, and everything was very stressful, and I didn't know where to turn. And then I did something that I hadn't done for a very, very long time. And in my desperation, I got down on my knees, and I cried out that, you know, if there is a God out there, I ask nothing for myself. I am not on good terms with you. I have no right to ask of anything. But I simply ask that you help my partner and that you give her the strength to make the right decisions and do what is best for her and the family. But I ask nothing for myself. And then the most remarkable thing happened. And after 30 years, God talked back. And I felt God there with me, and God told me what to do. And I looked up questioningly, and it's like, what was that? Am I talking to myself? You know, and like, what was, I don't know what that was. But I listened, and I went and did it, and things worked out okay, as these things tend to. And from that moment on, I was filled with a, I don't know what's going on, but I need to know more. And that's when I came to you.
It's not very often that I get to meet people in the community who come and see me and say, I know God's real because he's spoken to me and I've felt him and he's answered my prayer, but I don't know anything about him. And who's this Jesus anyway? And so from this point of God meeting Stan, because God was with Stan all the way through all of that, suddenly things had changed. I think you said 6 months. I'd have said it was about 2 months, actually, but that's, yeah. So tell us, in that time, what's changed? What's different? What are you doing now? And what do you think you might do at some point?
So, so interestingly, as it comes to Joseph, my background is in Egyptology, and I'm a qualified Egyptologist. I have a master's degree, went to university, specialized in hieroglyphs. That's what my thing was, but I never worked in that field because of various things, and I always wondered, why did I bother doing this? And then as time went on, and I did lots of other jobs and lots of things, and then came to Taunton. And then as I'm learning more about God and I'm learning more about Jesus, and I begin to think to myself, maybe God was with me all this time. Maybe he led me down certain paths and let me do different things to prepare me for what I think God has talk to me to do, which is to work for him and to speak on behalf of him, to eventually even maybe be ordained and work in the church. As I think I said to you, the feelings come on me now that once my eyes have been opened and now I'm absolutely sure, without a doubt, that there is a God, what else is there for me to do that to dedicate my life to him as I promised I would when I was 5? And that's not a path for everyone, but it's a path that I feel that God has told me to do in quite strong terms on a number of occasions. So that's kind of why I'm here now, as a tester, to see what it's like talking to people in a church.
So for the first time ever, you've just heard Stan speak in church. I think we're going to leave it there because there's other things I need to say. Thank you for doing that. I know it's not easy. I know it takes some guts, and probably your insides like mine are going blah, 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 and all that sort of stuff. So thank you for sharing that, because that was absolutely perfect. Thank you. So that's why I brought Stan. So this story that we've been thinking about today of Joseph, of his brothers, of his dad, of favoritism and of forgiveness, maybe already you're thinking and applying it to your life and your situation and people you know. It might be family, it might be friends, it might be people around you, all kinds of things. What have we learned so far? We've learned that God was with Joseph through everything. And I think we've learned that what God says to you and what God says about you, the love that he has for you, the compassion and the care that he has for you, that those things are still true, whatever the circumstances. There may be circumstances that other people have placed upon you, like Joseph. There may be situations and circumstances that you've placed on yourself a little bit like Stan has. But even if the circumstances indicate that it's not true, those things that God has said about you and over you are true. God is with you. And it got me thinking as well about the sort of person that Joseph was. And there's a word that I want to think about for a few minutes. I forgot to show you that one. What God says about you is true, even if it doesn't feel like it. I want to tell you about this man for a minute. It's why people were worried when I walked in earlier. I brought my golf club with me. This is a 6-iron. Don't use those very often. Usually sand wedges and things like that to get out of bunkers. But and I want to tell you about this man. This is a man called Bobby Jones. Some of you may have heard of Bobby Jones if you're into golf. Anybody recognize? No? No. Bobby Jones was the greatest golfer in the 1920s in the world. He would have been internationally known. He was Tiger Woods of his time. In 1925 at the US Open, he was favorite to win. Everyone knew he was going to win. He was the best player. He hit one of his shots, and a bit like I would have done, he ended up with his ball in the rough, in the longer grass. Rules have changed, I think, slightly now, but back then, certainly, and until quite recently, there were rules about what happens then. So he went into the rough, and he addressed the ball, using technical terms, which means basically he stood up and got ready to hit the ball. And as he got ready to hit the ball, and he put his club down towards it. He hadn't taken a swing or anything yet, but as he moved it, put his club down towards the ball, he touched the grass, the long grass that the ball was in, like you would do. And the ball moved. That much. Nobody else who was there saw that the ball had moved. They didn't have cameras like they do now that probably would have picked it up, but that back then they didn't. The ball moved a fraction of an inch. Nobody saw it, but he did. And if the ball moves, once you've addressed the ball, that counts as a shot. Even though you haven't hit the ball, it counts as a shot. And so Bobby Jones stood up and said to the person who he was playing with that day, and said to the people around, and said to the judge who was there with them, the referee, the ball moved, that was a shot. No one saw it, but he called the penalty on himself. Do you know what happened in the championship in 1925, the US Open? He tied. One shot made the difference between him winning and not winning, because they did a playoff and he lost the playoff. And afterwards, people tried to congratulate him on his sportsmanship and say how good it was that he'd done that. And his answer I've got written down so I could remember exactly what he said. It's a really interesting one. He said, "That's like congratulating someone for not robbing a bank. Because he'd just done the right thing. He'd done the honest thing. He'd used the word I want us to think about for a minute, integrity. No one would have known except him. And maybe God. Any mathematicians? Everyone's denying it. There's a word that we use in mathematics that comes from exactly the same root as this word does. And that word is an integer. Anyone feeling brave? What's an integer? It's a whole number. It's a complete number. We get it from the same roots of the Greek as this word integrity, because it's about wholeness and it's about authenticity and completeness and rightness and being upstanding and being whole. I don't often quote Oprah Winfrey in talks either. But she said, real integrity is doing the right thing, knowing that no one's going to know whether you did it or not. Doing the right thing, even if no one else knows. Doing the right thing, even when no one's watching. When it's not seen or acknowledged by anyone else. When it's not convenient to you. And it struck me that at times in this story, at the end of the story, Joseph displays integrity. He could have responded in anger. He could have responded in wanting revenge. He could have responded in getting rid of his brothers. How dare they come and see him after what they've done to him? But I think what he does there at the end is he displays integrity. And I think integrity should be the hallmark of all of us who claim to follow Jesus and be part of his family. Especially in our family relationships. So following Jesus isn't just an intellectual theory that we agree with. It's an active, lived out, practical, real lifestyle that we do even when it's not convenient. And that we do even when no one else is watching. There was a phrase a while ago about how we walk the walk and not just talk the talk. That's what integrity is. Any builders? This is in Florida. After a hurricane has blown through, and that's a housing estate by the sea with a road going through the middle with houses on both sides. There's something called structural integrity. We're having lots of new things built at the church in Taunton. We're hoping that our builders are working with structural integrity. It means that a building can stand safely, even if there's an earthquake or a hurricane, then the building with structural integrity remains standing. And actually, I think you only discover the reality of integrity in two situations. One is when the storm hits, when the crisis hits. You know whether your integrity stands at that point. But it also comes at the opposite end. It also comes with prosperity and with success. Because that actually tests your character infinitely more than hardship does. Because when your back's against the wall, you've got nowhere to go. But when you're successful, you can do it on your own. it's hard to look at yourself and look for the reactions that you give to situations. The responses to things that you have, those automatic things that happen before you even think about it. Especially when you're facing problems or when things are so good. It's only then that the truth of you is shown. Integrity doesn't mean being perfect, because no one is. But it means that when you make mistakes, when things go wrong, it's how you deal with them that reveals your integrity. And at the end of this story, Joseph is someone who has integrity, because the end of the story reveals a position where he could get his revenge, where he could get his own back, where all those hurts that have been stored up for years and years and years can finally be released. But instead, he remembers that God was with him and that God is with him. And his response is different. His response is one of forgiveness. His response is one of reconciliation. His response is one that you probably wouldn't expect of someone in that kind of position, but is one that shows integrity to who he is. Because we need to forgive others. I'm sure you know all the things about how when you forgive someone, it releases them from the hold you have on them. But actually, the bigger thing, it releases you from the hold they have on you. Never told this story before. I hadn't planned to tell this story, but I think I should. A few years ago, 20 years ago, I was working somewhere, leading a school's work project. I'd got people working on my teams. They had been for a few years. We were doing all kinds of amazing things in the local secondary school. At that time, it was the biggest secondary school in Europe. And we had offices in there. God had really blessed what we were doing. And there was someone who was on my team who was an interesting character. And at the end of the year that he'd been with me, I got called in to a meeting of my management group, who were basically the leaders of the 12 churches who were sponsoring the project. And they said, we've heard about some of the things that this person did, some of his behavior, some of the actions that he took that I knew nothing about. But because I was the team leader, I should have known about them. And so they said, because of his actions, and that you didn't know about it and do anything about it, we think you should find a different job. That hurts. When someone else has done something, and you are genuinely taking the blame for it, and taking the consequences of it. And then about a week later, no one knew anything. They'd said, you just say it's the end of your contract and they weren't going to make a big fuss about it. This particular person came to me and said, I'm going to be getting married in about 3 months' time and I'd really like you to be my best man. And so I was. And after 20 years, and I'm not saying that this is necessarily the right thing, but after 20 years, he still doesn't know why I left my job. Because I knew what it would do to him if I told him. I had to forgive him. His actions caused the consequences for me, and he still doesn't know that. and I had to forgive him. And at some point, I think I'm going to have to sit down and talk to him. But only when it's the right time. How did I do that? How do I do that? How is that possible? Because God is with me, I think, is the answer. He enables me to be able to let go of the hurt and to let go of the anger and to let go of the wanting revenge. I don't know what situation it is for you that maybe that equates to. It could be within a family. I know that's what you've been thinking about, and that's often where these things happen. It could be wider than that. But we need to be people who act with integrity, who act with forgiveness, because we know that God is with us, whatever the situation and the circumstance. And that the last point I've got is that God actually is a God of redemption. God redeems. God buys back what was meant for bad and turns it for good. Whether that's our fault or whether it's other people's fault, those bad things God is able to turn around. Not that he caused them to happen in the first place, but he takes that situation and redeems it. He turns it around. He buys it back for good. God can actually use the most painful times in our lives for his good. Because we know God is with us. God will be with us. Just as he was with Joseph. Let's just pray for a second and then I'll hand back, okay?